Well, I'm a privilege to have Brother Rick service this afternoon. Many of you have heard Brother Rick before, maybe some of you haven't, but we have appreciated Brother Rick's stand for the truth and example in witnessing and love the Lord. And today we think we have a real privilege to hear something that we wouldn't normally hear. And his thoughts are observations. Observations, Brother Rick.
Thank you, Brother Mark, and thank you, Brother Larry, for your prayer. And brethren, we want to give you the love and greetings of your brethren in Oakland County, where we meet. And we do also want to give you the love of my beloved Ruth, who wasn't feeling well and has one of those types of colds that kind of stay with you for days, and you seem like you're doing pretty good during the day, but you lay down at night and you cough and hack all night long, and she's decided not to share her germs with you, and so she stayed home as much as we would have liked her to have been here. And I do thank the Heavenly Father for the privilege of having some time here to express some thoughts with you. We entitled it Observations because that's basically what it is. We're going to share with you some observations for what they're worth. And it actually almost starts out a little bit like a report to begin with. One of the aspects of that we've been engaged in the last 20 years has been interacting with our brethren in India. Our first trip was in 1984, and we've had 5 trips there. And in between the trips, we've had a lot of different interaction via correspondence. First by, I don't know, if you've ever done overseas mailing, you might remember the little blue felt self-fold-up little envelope letters that you can't put anything in, and you send it off, and, well, by the way, they don't use that anymore. To now, of course, in more recent times, with the email, which has been a great blessing. And just to give you a little flavor, in case you do this overseas, to some of our brethren in maybe Africa as well as India, some brethren will have a computer at home. Some brethren will have a computer at work. Some will have it at the school that they might attend, especially if it's the university or college level. But others go to the computer cafe. And for a little bit of time, they have rent the use of the computer and type in their email name, as it were, and type in, usually on something like a Yahoo or something that doesn't cost them any money. And so sometimes you'll send an email, but they won't get a chance to go down to the computer cafe for a week or two due to their circumstances before they can check their email. And they'll write you back a little answer. But if you ask them a question on something that they don't have the information with them at the computer cafe, it might take another week to hear back from them. So even with email, you can't be discouraged if it might take 2 weeks to get a solid answer. And of course others, you know, they're emailing you back real time, as it were. But with all that being said, since 1998, there's been a tremendous work undertaken in India, particularly under the influence of a young brother who was very clear in the harvest message and very zealous and very talented in his method of presenting it and had ability. So from about 1998 up until, I'm going to say, 2003, or in 2005, just in the last couple of years, 8 different ecclesias had been formed through these efforts. And the number of consecrated is close to 600. And these individual brethren were taken through the harvest message in a course that we, for short, called the 52 lessons. 52 lessons start out with simple things like how the Bible was written, proceeds to the three worlds, the different ages, goes through about ransom for all, the restitution, all the way through chronology, the Lord's second presence, who the Antichrist is, the system of papacy, and finally coming to come out of her, my people, Babylon. But 52 lessons basically formulated on having one study a week to cover a subject. Some subjects, like the presence, would take 2 or 3 weeks. The Trinity would usually take 2 or 3 weeks. And the long and short of all of this is that after a year or 2 years' time of going through all these lessons, then those who remain would form an ecclesia. And that would be the basis. And that's where we say there's about, hey, I'm going to rattle off some names for you. I don't expect you to remember. I'll start with the easiest one to remember because we're familiar with this anyway. It's Bangalore. Bangalore, India. In that city today, there's about 6 different ecclesias. One of them had been started in about 1997, and another one just recently formed. But you've got brethren in Chittor and Vellore and Rajahmundry and Vizag. You've got brethren in Puttur, Tirupati, Chennai. In these locations, there were public meetings where literally thousands would come out. Then there were the follow-up meetings where the truth was systematically presented, where your numbers, of course, dwindled down to hundreds. And then what would happen as you got to subjects like the Trinity, your numbers would fall off even more. And then finally, you would have what we would call a core. So the smallest of one of those classes might be 15 to 20, and the largest would be 200, just depending on what took place. But the last of those 8 classes formed in the year 2003, just rounding things off. Now we're in 2005. So recently, what had happened is this leading individual, due to various influences, changed his mind on much of what we would term as present doctrinal prophetic truths. Let me define what I mean, because we all can have a different idea in our head. Present truth, we, as brethren, we would liken to the harvest message, that which we've received since 1874 with our Lord's return and his use of that wise and faithful servant, whom would present a harvest message to do what? To harvest out the wheat, to cause a sifting amongst those who would be faithful from those who would not. So we call that present truth for the time we're living in, recognizing that. So when I say present truth, that is truth that are somewhat unique to our time period, and that is, an example, would be the second presence. So I call that a doctrinal prophetic truth. The second presence wasn't the truth that was expected of the Church of Philadelphia or Smyrna or any earlier church. It's expected of the Laodicean church when the Lord would be present. Okay. Change his mind on that. Change his mind that we're not in the harvest. The harvest is yet future. That the harvest is an instantaneous work, where when the Lord would return, every eye would see him, every human would see him, and that living saints would be resurrected at the same time the sleeping saints were resurrected, and they'd just go up to heaven and have some kind of miraculous change as they'd be going up in the air. You could say pretty fairly that these changes along this line would be very similar to what we might find from the author of Left Behind type of series, evangelical Christian thinking of today. Still, of course, when I say of course, I should say, clarify that, doesn't believe in hellfire, doesn't believe in Trinity, doesn't believe in immortality, human soul, or any of those type of errors, but rather what I'm calling these present truth errors. The present truth doctrines is given up and now holds what we present as error. So that's the challenge that when I talk about summing up on giving up on the second presence, it's this broader picture of things. The chronology is wrong. The days of waiting are interpreted with different dates. Gentile times isn't the same kind of Gentile times as we would expect them to be. Now, with that, that's one angle. The other angle is that it's a doctrinal organizational changes. Now let me express what I mean by that. Present truth, doctrinal organizational changes. Present truth in the sense that you and I have been blessed with an understanding that there is no clergy laity in the Word of God. That we're all brethren and we're not to call anyone else a master, call no man father on earth, for one is your father in heaven. We've been blessed with that. We might sometimes take it for granted because we've had it for so long. But that is a great truth, is it not? So, the organization of the new creation, the ecclesia arrangement, how much of that can we trace back through the Dark Ages? How many of our brethren had the freedoms and have organized themselves the way we organize ourselves during this present truth harvest time period? When the call went out by our returned Lord, come out of her, my people. Revelation 18:4. Come out of her, my people. Where was he calling us to? And what was he calling us out from? He was calling us out from Babylon. That's the context of Revelation 18. Calling us out of the nominal church systems to where? To gather on the carcass. That's true. What's the carcass? Present truth. That's what we're feeding on. But we have to have an arrangement when we come together, right? We can't have anarchy. God is not the God of confusion. So what do we have? The returned Lord gave us the understanding of the ecclesia arrangement. And now, even though Paul had written this to Titus and to Timothy about how to elect elders and deacons, how many of the nominal church system, the mother of harlots, how many of them had elections of elders and deacons the way we understand it, with one consecrated person, one vote? And your vote, and your vote, and my vote, it's each one vote. We have an equal vote. An elder doesn't have more of a vote than a sister or a brother who's not an elder. You know what I'm, right? We're all agreed, right? One consecrated individual, one vote is an equal vote. Everyone has a right to express themselves. That's why we have these long business meetings. And everyone will express themselves, even if it's already been expressed. But the beauty of that is, that's our price of liberty. We laugh about it because it's so true. That's our price of liberty. Isn't it an easy price to pay? Next time you're sitting in a long business meeting, stop and think. This is a pretty easy price to pay. This chair is pretty comfortable. I'm sitting in this air conditioning. It's heated. It's a simple price to pay for the liberty we enjoy, which we almost take for granted because we've had it for so long. Well, this brother has changed his opinion on that. And he feels he should be a pastor and should appoint leaders in the churches that he started. That, to me, is what I'm calling a change in present truth doctrine organization. These are the two areas where these challenges have arisen of late. Now, nothing comes up out of the blue. We all know enough about human nature that there's always seed thoughts somewhere along the line, and they get watered one way or the other. We can either nip them in the bud, or we can encourage them. So I never like try to get into someone's head and try to unravel what makes someone what they are, because I can't even do that for myself perfectly. But the thought is that we have to deal with what we have, what we can see, and what we've heard, and what we can demonstrate. That's what we're asked to deal with. So there, this has been the challenge to these eight newer ecclesias in India. Are these new views, these changes, correct? Or have what we've been taught by this individual correct? Which way do we go? Now, try to create a little bit of a understanding for our brethren in that situation in India. And please recognize, I'm not talking about all the brethren in India. I'm talking about these newer classes that have been formed in the last 6-7 years. Most can't read English. They don't have the volumes in their own language. Put yourself back into the truth movement in Brother Russell's day. Take your pick. So let's say the 1880s. What would you have in the 1880s? Tabernacle Shadows? And if it was after 1886, you might have the first volume. What else did you get? A magazine? Once a month, I think, then. Maybe twice a month by then. But it was on a series of articles. Maybe they related to what you were doing, or maybe they didn't. What else did you have? Did you have a church building to go to? Probably not. Did you have maybe a pilgrim brother that could come out and see you? Well, maybe. And how often would they be there? Put yourself back there. What did we do? I came out of Methodism, or I came out of the Baptist, or I came out of Roman Catholicism in the 1880s. Pick your state, Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, Florida, wherever you want. What did I do? Got in contact. Maybe a colporter came through. You got some names. The colporter had gone his own way. You got the magazine. Maybe you wrote up to Allegheny And you asked, you know, the editor, you know, where can I meet? And maybe he sent you some other names in your little podunk town out in a rural area, and you got together with them and started to read the little bit of information you had, and you had to figure out. We didn't have any priests. We didn't have ministers. We didn't have reverends. We didn't have clergy laity. And all I'm saying to you in this is that you and I didn't have to go through that. Our brethren that have preceded us did that groundwork for us. And we're living after 1906, so what do we got? We got the sixth volume with the Organization of New Creation chapters right in there. We got something we can study. And we've got it in our mother tongue. And we've each been introduced to it by someone who's been through it and can kind of help point out the way. So we have advantages. So now you and I, when we read what Paul wrote to Timothy and Titus about electing elders and deacons, we can understand it without any of these other blinders on. And that's the blessing. Now, so our brethren in these newer classes are struggling with that right now. And it's been the privilege of a number of brethren here to be able to send them information to try to help them in their decision making. From cassette tapes to reprints to volume sections to discourses to emails, letters, personal contact this way, to encourage them as they're having now to wrestle with the very difficult situation of one who's been so instrumental in bringing so much truth to them for the last 5, 6, 7 years, now teaching something different. Is there loyalty to the personality? Do you give credence to the one who it seems the Lord has used to bless you to get you to this point? Without that contact, who else will be in contact with us? Where else will we get our help or instruction? So the beauty of it is we know who's in charge of the harvest, right? It's the glorified Lord. He's in charge. What are we? Tools. Tools that maybe he can use. At best, we're tools that maybe he can use. So what do? Well, we don't fret, we don't wring our hands, we don't get all worked up and overwrought. We leave it to the Lord, but we look intelligently to see in what way can we render assistance to these dear brethren that if I was in their position, I would like someone to do for me. And that's what the friends have been trying to do. Now, I got home March 29th. And what are we at today? June 11th. A little over 2 months. So I want to just relate briefly to you what's happened in a little over 2 months. In Chittor, the leading brethren decided that they would sever all ties with this one who had brought them into the truth because of their changes. And that they would study the harvest message. And there's 35 there. In Velor, 15 of them made the same decision. In Rajamundry, the entire class of 75 made that decision. In Vizag, which is short for a very long word, in Vizag, there was 40 of them who decided to stay with the truth. In Chennai, they're right now going through the very difficult throes. Out of 60, 15 younger brethren in their 20s are now making a good stand to hold to the presence the way they've understood it. And they write that many others are wavering one way or the other. In Bangalore, 70 have separated. Brethren, it's interesting. Let me develop this a little bit more. In some of these places, there was verbal confrontation over these views. And this was no easy thing for these brethren to stand up to the very one who had been their blessing. Imagine how that must have been like. One that brought you all these beautiful truths, and now they've changed, and you have to make a decision. So, sometimes some question There's so many over there. Could they all be spirit begotten? Well, can all of us, brethren, that we acknowledge as brethren, I say, all be spirit begotten? I leave that with the Lord. But I know some of us are. But I know what to look for. Because we've been blessed. The Harvest Messenger has written a whole chapter about what we should each look for as brethren to see if we've got the witness of the Holy Spirit. And brethren, I see it in you, but I see it in these brethren in India. They're suffering for the truth's sake. They know what the truth is. They know they're not Jehovah's Witnesses. They know they're not laymen. They've come out from the field and from the mill. They've left family members. Pastors have left churches. They've given up salaries to meet where? On the rooftops of homes. What do we give them? Nothing. I'm not financially, through Oakland County, supporting any one of these classes. They aren't getting anything. We send literature, we send help. Not sending money to any one of these classes. They're doing it because they love the truth. And brethren, they're going through exactly what Brother Russell explained in the third volume, all about the cleansing of the sanctuary. They made the multiple steps to get out of Babylon and its errors. And that cost them. Now they're going through the multiple steps of going through the further sifting of the cleansing of the antitypical temple class. By what? The whip of small cords. By what? The doctrines. What doctrines? Second presence. And the organization of the new creation. No clergy laity. The wise and foolish virgin, I'm very glad that Brother Dan had his discourse preceding to this, because it relieves me from having to lay a lot of that groundwork again, which you brethren know, but we were going to talk about that a bit, but he did such a good job. But that's one of the parables that is what? It's a harvest parable, isn't it? Because you can't have that parable take place until the bridegroom is present. So what does it demonstrate? We should look for these siftings on the presence. And brethren, it does take place here in America too. I could name some names. I'm not going to bother because that's not necessary. But you know, that happens from time to time. Well, this is what the brethren in India, these newer brethren, are going through right now. And that's exactly what we should expect. The large numbers that first came out to the public meetings seem incredible. Well, they are, because we don't get large numbers like that out here in the United States. But, as the brethren suspected, and it's true, it's whittled down, 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 down. Tens of thousands have heard the truth presentation there. But the numbers I rattled off to you earlier, it adds up to about 250. About 250. To my mind, the equation seems about right. This is what we see in a harvest time. This is what we see, how the Lord gradually winnows away with his people to get those who will what? Follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. And that's what these brethren are doing. And their tests aren't over, and our tests aren't over. We each, and they too, will have to make determinations from time to time as the Lord brings the information or the experience across our path to intelligently decide which way is the Lamb going. And then have the discernment and the fortitude to follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. So, there's great sorrow in our heart, yet there's great rejoicing. There's rejoicing in that we see brethren taking a good position, one that we can really appreciate and admire for what they're doing. Now, I thought a couple of things as part of these observations I'd share. The way the Lord timed my visit to India, I hadn't been there in about 6 or 7 years. And from time to time, brethren would say, you know, don't you think you should kind of go and see what's happening? And look, that's good advice. I thought that was good. But there were various reasons I didn't. But one of them was I really didn't want any of that energetic work to be perceived as coming from an American. In other words, the new interests are coming out to the foreigners there. Let it be a homegrown effort. And it was. So even now, let me say that when I went over and realized what was taking place and came back home, I looked at my visa and I go, you know, I got a 6-month visa. I could turn around and go back. And part of me felt like doing that. But no. The Lord is the Lord of harvest. He's directed the issue. Let us do what good we can do from here. But obviously the Lord has these brethren developed to the point that they're ready for this. And they are. And they have been. And I think they've been responding beautifully. So I think that's one of these providential overrulings that astounded me, because I wouldn't have timed it that way. I thought I should have gone earlier to preempt the trial. That wasn't what the Lord wanted. He wanted the trial. You know, it's not unlike, in a way, how when Brother Russell died, the brethren had all everything they needed to be developed to withstand the trial of pastor going down the veil. But how many withstood the trial? How many stayed loyal to the society, so to speak? Probably the majority. The long and short of that is, I'm just pointing out, is that once again, we might think that maybe we could have prevented the trial by preempting it. But actually, the Lord had it take place just as He desired it. Now, today, even as we speak, there, I always get this mixed up, but I think there are 14 and a half hours ahead of us. I think that's it. 14 and a half hours ahead of us. In the town of Chittor, the leading brethren from 6 of these 8 ecclesias that I mentioned are all meeting, and they're having what they're calling a Reformation Convention. The thought is that they are meeting with one another to encourage each other in their new environment and how they should proceed from here, having interaction together to firm each other up. I didn't recommend to them that they do this. I don't know of anyone else that did. I think they were inspired within themselves to do just what the brethren did here many, many years ago, and not so long ago, when they decided, let's get together with other brethren and see how we can communicate and keep contact and build each other up in the most holy faith. They're doing that this weekend. So afterwards, by the Lord's grace, we hope to put out a little report, which is one of the reasons I've been waiting as long as I have since I've returned home. I sent out a little trip report of what I saw when I was there, but I've waited as much as I've really had to rein myself in from not sending each of you out updates of some of the fantastic good stands they've taken for themselves since. We wanted to wait and see things settle a little more, and we didn't want to be overly premature, and this is one of the things we were waiting for. So we look forward to maybe sharing, Lord willing, some of that information with you down the road. There is a very interesting aspect to this, that there is a brother who, probably in his 30s, I should know, but I don't really, I didn't, I've never asked his age, but he's in his 30s, he's extremely zealous, very good knowledge of the truth, came into the truth under this other brother's influence a number of years ago, and he's been in full-time activity. And he has what he calls the 53 lessons. I remember I mentioned earlier the 52. Well, these are the 53 lessons. And he's written them all out. And I have them. And they're going through them now. And he's also sent some CDs. The brother has heard his public message, how he has some of these public messages for people. You know, like we would have a tape. I can see some of the brethren here have given public messages, and they have a cassette tape you give out or a CD now. Well, he does the same with CDs. Very well done, I think. The long and short of it is, as he's traveled around, he is continuing presenting the message in the same way that the other brother did. And he's having follow-up meetings in a number of different cities, And some of the older brethren, as it were, when I say older brethren who have been in the truth on their own for years, are starting to adopt the same messages and the same tactics and are having public meetings. And they're having follow-up meetings. And I just got an email last week of one of the follow-up meetings. There was about 30 in attendance. And the brother was writing to me very specifically. He says, I want you to understand. I said, I've got two doctors, two pastors, a dentist, and a computer engineer that are attending these meetings. In other words, brethren, these newer brethren, they aren't coming out because they're benefiting temporally, even though that's a side effect. Even I benefit temporally by the Lord's grace. That's a side benefit by giving me some clear thinking. But they're coming out for the spiritual benefit. There are so many computer programmers and computer engineers amongst these new brethren over there, you'd be amazed. But if you're in the computer field and you know anything about what's going on in India, particularly Bangalore and those other areas, you won't be amazed because you know how much activity has taken place via the internet and satellite connections with people in India in general. So that there's at least right now four consecrated doctors in India. How many doctors do we have consecrated in the U.S., for an example? So I'm just saying that to illustrate that it's the better educated that are receiving the truth there, and people who, they aren't rich by our standards, but they didn't come looking for temporal gain. They really came for the spiritual message. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because in the pastor's day, how many were still working with outhouses amongst the brethren? Probably quite a few. Do we think that because someone used an outhouse that they weren't intelligent, they weren't successful, or they couldn't have a depth of the Holy Spirit? Why relate that? Just to, you know, remind ourselves. When we think of our brethren in some of these poorer nations, just because they're poorer, and they don't have infrastructure like we do in this wealthier country, we aren't to think that somehow, in any way, that they would be inferior or they're trying to come to the truth for some type of temporal benefit. It's just something to think about, especially when I think about the Lord and the apostles and how the early church was arranged. Now, in Rajahmundry, the meeting there is a retired brother and sister, Brother Kotalingam, and fortunately, it's Sister Ruth. A name not only I can pronounce, one I can remember. And they have a meeting of 75. The night we were there and spoke, there was 100 there, but their class was 75. And they meet on their flat roof. Very convenient, as long as you can stand about 120 degree heat, because there's no fans. They put up lights because it's dark. And what do the lights do? So they sit there, a sweltering, but it's cooler at night than in the day, so you have the meeting in the evening when the sun's down. And that's where they hold the meeting, plastic chairs, they have a PA system, thanks to the brother from here that contributed. But they also built a little baptismal tank on the side of the house. Had a little immersion service. We were there. So when I think of the early church, and I think of them as it were maybe in Israel, when we read in Acts, the first chapters about how 3,000 came out in one day, where do you think the 3,000 went to meet? I mean, I don't have an answer for you. Just think about it. Where do you think 3,000 in one day, pretty soon you've got 6,000 meeting after a few months, after Pentecost, and they were living in a communal type of arrangement. Think, where did they meet? Where did thousands meet? And there's certainly no PA system then. So it's just kind of amazing. You know, it's just something to think about. But the Lord has added His blessing and provided. And I just relate this, that this is what we see in some of these countries that we go to that aren't like America in the same way, but it does not detract at all from their depth of spirituality. The Lord doesn't spare them either. As I'm relating to you, they get tests just like we get our tests. They're getting their tests. Brother, you were trying to relate something to me. I'm happy to receive it if there's something you think I should relate. of the things that I thought was interesting, you know, is there can be a tendency to have, as it were, this is kind of can be a problem in India, in the older classes, sometimes, like a chief elder. The oldest brother could be like the elder because of the patriarchal system in society, and have like assistant elders. You know, I never would have envisioned this, but this very trial that has affected these eight ecclesias, and there's these separations taking place, one of the greatest blessings it's been is, in them seeking some guidance and direction, we've been able to demonstrate that chief elders, there is no such thing as chief elders. There's elders and deacons and other officers of the ecclesia. And you have some type of regular elections, whether annually or some other arrangement, because no one's elected for life. And this is a two-fold safeguard. Safeguard for the church, as it were, safeguard for the brother or sister who might be an officer. So we're giving an opportunity to give input in a way that they hopefully can digest and agree with. So far, it's met with wonderfully positive response, because you've eliminated a ingrown leader that everyone naturally would gravitate to. Now, you know, for example, there's no scripture where we elect pastors. We elect elders. And among our elders, some naturally have the talent, or spiritually are given the talent, of having pastoral abilities. And they rise to that occasion, as it were. But we're not opposed to the term pastor per se, as long as it's understood this is just an elder that has this ability. The one exception might be what? Think about it for a minute. Well, we would say Pastor Ruffell, because some ecclesias voted him as their pastor and they had elders. Well, when I thought about that, I thought, well, where might you find that? And what I come up with is there's seven messengers to the church. There's 12 stars, 12 angels, 12 apostles. And there were seven stars held in the right hand of our Lord, Revelation, the first chapter, seven messengers to the church. So if there is someone who you would lay hands on, as it were, by extending a vote, to be a pastor, and in the days when Brother Russell was alive, then I could see maybe based on that grounds. But there's only seven, and there's only one per church. And we're in Laodicea, and we don't expect an eight. So we don't elect pastors, do we? We elect elders, out of which some can be pastors. You know, one of the things, sometimes we were asked questions about sisters' role in the church and so on, and one of the things that struck us is what we could write back on a number of things. But, you know, while to some it sounds maybe limiting on one hand, I don't think it is, but some might feel that. But on the other hand, when we explain that sisters get one vote and brothers get one vote, there's the simplicity in Christ. There's the same mutual responsibility. The brother and the sister have a mutual responsibility of who they set up as their teachers in the church and who they lay hands upon. That's rather empowering when you think about it. And I thought that was quite interesting, because actually what might seem restrictive on one hand, because we don't have teachers as public expounders in the church or as elders, the point is they have an equal responsibility on who will be elders and deacons and others in the church. And that is a very important role. And I hope it's not one that anyone takes for granted. Now, I have to say that I have noticed in my lifetime, in the truth, which we all claim to be real long, but I've had the peculiar situation that the Lord has put upon my heart to just address briefly. I've seen two extremely talented, well-grounded individuals in the truth do excellent work in bringing the truth to other people, and they both get sidetracked. Two totally different reasons, two totally different ways. One gave up on doctrine, the other one never gave up on doctrine, but the other one gave up, as it were, on the work. They got sidetracked into something else. This text right here, this one thing I do, they got sidetracked from doing that one thing. And the dramatic change is just hard to almost fathom unless you see it for yourself. It's a warning to me to recognize I don't have near that talent. But how cautious we each need to be to remember that anything we have is given to us by God and can be taken at any time if our heart is not humbled and kept before Him. But I want to deepen this a little bit. I can't say every leader, but certainly the vast majority have a certain quality, and I'm going to call it intensity. Intensity. Intensity is a very interesting quality that can be wonderfully channeled into the Lord's work to accomplish and motivate, and it can also have its own seeds of destruction to lead a person very intently, intensely away from serving the Lord aright. Think for a moment of different ones that you consider as leader amongst the brethren. And I'm not talking about just brothers or sisters that have great influence as well. Never underestimate that. They're usually people with intensity. And I'm not talking, when I say intensity, I don't mean someone who, you know, is always very dramatic. There's people who are extremely quiet, and that's how they convey their intensity. Intensity is a wonderful talent to use in the Lord's service because it motivates, it keeps you focused, it drives you. It can be to an intense person accomplishing something, whether it's in the form of study or witnessing or service. It can be very satisfying. They see a goal, they go for it. But some of the drawbacks of intensity are these. It's very easy for an intense person to get tunnel vision, just what they're doing, what they're witnessing on, or what they're serving, or what they're studying. Should be what everybody should be studying. Should be what everybody's doing. How come they're not behind this work? Another drawback to intensity. An intense person can get very discouraged if they don't see other brethren as intense about what they're intense about. Now that might sound funny, but think about it. An intense person is so charged up on a subject, whether it's very openly or very quietly, that that's what they're trying to persuade others about because they feel so strong about it. But if others aren't responding, they can get very discouraged. Sometimes they can think that the brethren aren't that spiritual. Sometimes they might think they're not sacrificing enough. Maybe they're thinking they're not studious enough. Maybe, you know what I mean? They can just start actually berating the brother in their own mind or even verbally to others because they don't see that same level of intensity and in the thing that they're intense about. It's a problem. It can be a problem. I consider the Apostle Paul to be a very intense person. I think the Apostle Peter was a very intense person. I think they're two different personality types, but they both had a commonality of intensity. They know how to channel it. Peter took a little more rubbing this way, Paul a little more rubbing that way, but nonetheless, by the grace of God, they channeled it, and they were marvelous. And I think that's one of the reasons why we know more about them in the New Testament, because they were intense apostles whom the Lord worked with them to channel their energies in the right way. And they did stay with the one thing I do. So, I don't have an answer for you on this, but I would like to put forward to you, if you're an intense individual, if you can honestly assess that in yourself, maybe kind of weigh up a few of the warning signs I gave, and let's ask ourselves, am I showing any of these symptoms? Another thing, if you know someone who's intense that you're working with in the truth or in some way, this way, if you have dealings with them, maybe in your ecclesia or maybe in some activity or whatnot, think about that as a personality trait that can actually be a good thing. Don't let it irritate you so much. And see how you can help them. Remember how Brother Russell in one place says, we don't know how much credit's going to go to Priscilla and Aquila for the Apostle Paul's efforts because they helped him. He was the intense one. I'm not saying they weren't. I don't know that much about him. The Bible doesn't tell us. But they were willing to help this very intense brother. And they were probably willing to overlook a lot of what they would find otherwise irritating because they stayed focused. Now, one of the other elements that we wanted to mention on this is that when someone is in a position of bringing someone else into the truth, raising maybe children up in the truth or a relative, maybe it's you're a leading brother or a leading sister. And when I say a leading sister, what I mean is that there are mothers in Zion, spiritual mothers in Zion that are looked to. And you have this type of influence. And again, I think it was Brother Dan in his discourse brought out the quote today. But the point is that we should each be sure that with all the mentoring or influence that we might be exercising toward these others, that we'd always accompany it with their own spiritual independence. Spiritual independence and spiritual liberty. In the two cases that I have been thinking about, what eventually happened that was similar between the two, besides intensity and great talent, was that eventually it got to the point where they were equating loyalty to the truth with loyalty to their personality. Very sobering. We can think that being loyal to the truth is actually being loyal to us. Brother, we aren't loyal to people. We appreciate people. We respect people. We have confidence in people. But be very careful of loyalty to people. We're loyal to God. We're following the Lamb. And if we find that we're using our influence to try to make people loyal to us, we've crossed the line from being a mentor and spiritually developing a healthy spiritual child to making someone spiritually dependent upon us. That's a great burden. I have felt that burden. I have felt that. And one of the greatest tests to me in times past was having to take a different position than one whom I viewed as it were, like a mentor. Very, very, very difficult to know you're disappointing someone who you love so much. The best thing we can do is to teach that spiritual independence and let their love and appreciation for us, even if we end up down the road differing on something, let them always remember us fondly as giving them the independence and liberty to follow the Lamb as they saw fit.
Is that time up, brother?
Thank you. That's why I make sure, because I can go over very easily. Which takes precedent? Ecclesia liberty or personal liberty? Which takes precedent? Well, let me ask you this. When ecclesia votes, aren't they, in a sense, voting an ecclesia conscience? I think so. I think that's not what we normally say, but I think it's a pretty good view. If we're in a business meeting and something's been discussed, a certain topic, and the ecclesia has to reach a decision, the ecclesia votes, that's what they decide to do, that's an ecclesia conscience. Let's say you're voting on a speaker. You all conscientiously extend your hand for the speaker you agree with, or you don't. But that's like, now it becomes an ecclesia conscience, as it were. But each individual has that right to express their own conscience on whether to vote or not, in favor or not. The individual conscience is superior in the sense that the Lord is not calling an organization or an ecclesia. He's calling individuals. And he works to develop individuals within ecclesias. But we always must remember that first and foremost, we have to be true to our conscience before the Lord rather than to think, well, I'll go along with an ecclesia, whether I agree or not, on a point. Now, there's times where you can. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying everything disagrees. That's the problem. But what I am saying is that we bear individual responsibility over just going along with the crowd to make our decisions. Now, where does this become important? I think the importance comes down to what I'm going to present is, and it's an observation. That's what I call this talk. It's an observation. In these ecclesias in India, but having the same trial. In some of the ecclesias, the majority decided to stay with the present truth. In other ecclesias, the majority decided to take the new adopted view and change. So in some of the ecclesias, the brethren holding to the present truth could stay, and other ecclesias, same issue, they left. You see, staying and leaving isn't what's right or wrong. It's your individual conscience before the Lord, which you have to follow that Lamb whithersoever he goes. And then you try to work within the scriptural arrangement of the ecclesial arrangement as it's given to us. And sometimes you have to start anew. And that's what the brethren did in 1916 and afterwards, after Pastor Russell went beyond. That's what they had to do. They had to make their decisions. So, I just say all that because I just happen to be in this point in time where these observations are pressing upon our hearts and minds, and we want to share them in a way that hopefully, in our experiences, we learn from observing what our brother might be passing through and put it into an historical context into what we ourselves might do when we're confronted with some of these same tests in our own way. And we thank you for your time.